This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Infertility may be a lot bigger problem than you would imagine. Statistics say that one in every eight couples struggles to conceive or to maintain a pregnancy. On top of that, it's a problem that many simply don't discuss. According to a couple interviewed recently on the topic by CNN, infertility is an unspoken disease. People feel shame and they hide it. Now, that may surprise you, but you may have also been surprised by the use of the word disease when describing infertility. But that is how the medical community views it. If you are among the one in eight couples dealing with infertility, it may comfort you to know that you live in a very good place. Charlotte has been described both as a hub of knowledge in the field of infertility research and as a small city with a big city infertility treatment activist and research presence. So this hour, during this National Infertility Month, we meet some of the people on the front lines of that research here in Charlotte. Professor Bethany Johnson is a research faculty associate in the Department of Communication and a research affiliate for UNC Charlotte's Women and Girls Research Institute, who is currently conducting research on patient-practitioner communication in reproductive endocrinology practices, along with Margaret Quinlan, an associate professor of communication and a core faculty member of the Health Psychology PhD program at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to both of you, and I apologize for my voice.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome. I'll quickly change that impression of yours in just a second here. How did Charlotte come to have such a strong presence in the field of infertility research and treatment?
I think that's an interesting question. I think both Dr. Quinlan and I sort of got dropped into something that was already happening. So when I came to Charlotte 3 years ago, you already had a Resolve support group. You already had a couple of treatment facilities that were doing their own research, that were able to bank embryos and were doing fertility preservation. So that is, I think Dr. Johnson will talk a little bit more about that later, mm-hmm. but that has to do with helping people who may have, maybe about to get cancer treatment, for example. They may want to bank embryos or follicles, which are eggs, to make sure that they can then go through fertility treatments after their cancer treatment so that they can still get pregnant and those eggs won't be impacted by the radiation.
But why Charlotte? Is it normal for a city this size to have that those kinds of facilities, those kinds of projects, those kinds of clinics available to people?
I don't think so. I didn't expect to find that here. And I think living in a town with a research university as wonderful as UNC Charlotte really helps. Mm-hmm. So the work that Dr. Quinlan and I do that's funded inside of and outside of the university is able to meet up with people in the city, find out what's happening. We also have alternative health care here, acupuncture and dietary support and things that there are some of the REI specialists in the city also really approve of and their patients go to. That was another thing that was surprising to us to find that there are so many resources here.
I mentioned that about 4,000 people a year in Charlotte seek out infertility treatments. So put that number into context. Is that about average for a city this size? Is it larger? And if it's larger, is it larger because we have these places that people can go? Or that people are coming here because we have these places and their city doesn't have those places?
What's interesting, I don't know. I would be interested to hear what you think as well, Dr. Quinlan, but I would say the number might be larger because there are people that don't seek treatment, don't know they can seek treatment, and don't know about the resources.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've learned through this research with Bethany is just the taboo and the silence surrounding infertility. So I think if there aren't places and if you're in small towns where people aren't having the conversations and there aren't support groups and different activists and different people talking about this problem, that people don't know and they feel alone and they don't know who to ask the questions mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. So part of our research is we're interested in helping female patients have agency during treatment. We're interested in how different structures can enable and constrain those going through the actual fertility process and how to help individuals communicate better with their practitioners because they're already experiencing different tensions in their relationships, sexual dysfunction, self-esteem issues, fear of being isolated. And so they go into these interactions with a lot going on in their lives and trying to get the best care possible.
Yeah, you point out that it's not just the fact that they can't conceive. There's a host of other issues that come along with
Absolutely.
It because they can't conceive and because of all the gymnastics they have to go through to try to conceive. It brings on depression. It brings on self-esteem, as you said, self-esteem issues. And there is this general shame associated with it. Why? It's 2016. Why?
I think there's still very much a pronatalist discourse in our society.
What does that mean?
That we expect that women will become mothers, and there's a lot of expectation on us that that it's our biological destiny to reproduce. And when women find out that either they or their partner are having difficulty with that, that brings a lot of other stigmas connected to it that that individuals have to work through. And so for us, we're interested in helping them to make sense of this, not only with their partner, with their medical practitioners, but how to navigate the system, you know, through these formal and informal contexts.
I was going to ask you, is this part of the treatment, or is this part of what you're trying to do through your research to figure out how much of this should be part of the treatment, helping people through that aspect of the problem?
I think both and. So what we're hoping to do with our research is one thing that we talk a lot about with people that we interview and also with practitioners that are working in the field, the practitioners are doing surgery, they're meeting with patients, they're trying to keep up with what's going on in their field, new protocols. Patients have to fight with their insurance companies, learn how to go through this treatment, figure out how to do lifestyle changes, manage their work schedule with 3 appointments in a week. People are so overwhelmed in the process that us being able to be outside of the process and say, let's look at these communication issues. Let's create some resources for practitioners and patients to bring into the room, because we can focus on this with more of a laser point focus. And then doctors and patients can keep managing all of those things that they have to manage. When you said earlier, you know, there are all of these other issues, depression and anxiety, and Maggie mentioned the pronatalist society. What was so interesting is the follow-up questions. I was teaching a class once on early American healthcare, wasn't talking about childbirth, and a student raised their hand and said, "Do you have children?" And I said, "I don't have children." And they said, "Why?" And there were 63 of us in the room, you know, and the student was, it was just an innocent question, but I don't think people realize what a personal question that is.
It's kind of a rude question,
a bit. And the student, you know, was just curious, you know, it was right. Coming from a place of curiosity. But I've had strangers in the grocery store in Charlotte say, "Do you have children?" "No." "Why?" "Do you not like children?" is often the follow-up question. So I think one of the reasons why there's silence around this issue is that really well-meaning, curious people will ask you questions that sort of shut down the conversation from the beginning and leave you feeling like you have to answer very loaded questions.
Wow. Studies have shown, I understand, that female infertility patients have regularly reported a discrepancy between the support they wanted and the support they experienced when they began the process of trying to figure out how to overcome this. What does that mean? What kind of support were they hoping for?
Well, I think when a lot of women and men start the fertility process, they think it's potentially going to be, you know, one quick fix, and they'll be you know, able to get pregnant and move on from there. And as, you know, Bethany, I've learned that a lot of the women in our study have been going through treatment for years and years. And so what we've learned by asking women, you know, what do you find supportive, what do you find unsupportive from your practitioners, that they want to be included in care, that they want to learn and participate in the process, that they want to have a cooperative relationship with their nurses, with their doctors.
And that doesn't happen?
Well, I think in our study we found, and this is across the country, so not just Charlotte-based, that women are often asked questions where they almost feel like the practitioner doesn't trust them or trust them to know their bodies, that they're wanting somebody to listen to them, to include their story into the process, instead of imposing ideas onto a woman's body and to help them through the process. that we, at this point, Bethany and I have talked a lot about this, that we don't know about the role of stress and the impact on the body. And as a communication scholar, I'm interested in how the words that doctors use, the words, the way that doctors disclose potentially really painful and distressing information, how that can impact an individual, not just during treatment, but in terms of what decisions they make for their family.
Given that we have more facilities and treatment centers and programs and support groups that you mentioned, Bethany, than an average city of this size, are women finding the kind of support they are that they want here, or are we still falling through the cracks here?
I think a lot of women in treatment, you do have to become your own advocate. And part of the reason has nothing to do with the practitioner. It has to do with the treatment itself. So you meet with your practitioner, but if you do something like an IUI, which is an intrauterine insemination, it used to be called artificial insemination, if you do IVF, or if you are just monitoring your ovulation for your doctor, a lot of that actually happens at home. And you're doing it yourself. So the relationship between practitioners and patients has to be different in infertility because you're doing a lot of the treatment maybe in front of your refrigerator at home. So we're finding that the type of support people need is also something that's not appropriate for the practitioner to give you. My practitioner is not a social worker. They're not a counselor. So they're not equipped and shouldn't be equipped to give me this kind of support. Now, a local group like Resolve, Resolve is the national infertility awareness association. The woman that runs the Charlotte group, her name is Stacy Ellen, and there are women from all over the city. They're being treated at various facilities in the city. Some of them are being treated outside of the city. People come together on a monthly basis. They share their stories. They talk about their protocols, their doctors, their nurses. They're saying what works, what doesn't work for them. In the times that I visited that group, that was the most wonderful experience because everyone in the room knew something about what you were going through. But if people don't know about Resolve, if they assume that Charlotte doesn't have a group because it's a smaller city, they could miss out on really, really valuable supports that will then hopefully improve their communication with their practitioners.
I know that, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, you have personal experience with this.
I do.
Is that one reason why you have embarked, the two of you have embarked on this project to see how doctors and healthcare professionals can better communicate with patients because of that and some of the things that perhaps you noticed in your own care?
Yeah, there is a genesis story to our study. We've now interviewed 25 women from around the country. We have 1,000 pages of transcript. We have 4 articles in press, 4 under review, 2 outlined. We're just loving everything that we've learned from this. But it started when we were traveling. We were in Brooklyn, New York, looking in some medical archives about another topic. I'm a medical historian. I study women's health history. I was researching birth when I didn't know if I would become a parent. This was not a part of my personal story, but it's fascinating to me, so we kept with it. I was going through an IVF cycle at the time, and I was going to find out how my embryos were, our embryos, myself and my husband's embryos were doing, and they call you and give you an update. So I got a call in the shower, and that voicemail and how poorly that went over the next 48 hours was what caused the study.
That's an interesting story, and maybe we can elaborate on that when we come back from the break, because it was very impersonal given the situation and the condition that we're talking about. Professor Bethany Johnson and Dr. Margaret Quinlan with us on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, celebrating Mother's Day with the Henderson Collection Trunk Show Wednesday, May 4th, followed by the Clara Williams Trunk Show May 5th through 7th, Borrowcroft Village, South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. Well, you've heard of Star Wars, but here in Charlotte, we're in the midst of grocery wars. The battle is on for our food dollars as longtime homegrown Titan Harris Teeter continues to spar with Florida-based Publix. Even as the invader is building stores across the street from Harris Teeter, the nation's top supermarket, Wegmans, is also planning to come here. What's behind the supermarket boom, and what does it mean for you? If you missed the time, if you missed this program last time we aired it, you will find out when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show. All three GOP candidates gather in California for a statewide convention. Prospects for frontrunner Donald Trump as the nomination race heads into the final stretch. The ongoing divide within the party and what it all means for the general election.
That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about infertility this morning, and we'll bring in another guest in a moment or two from the medical aspect of this. But we're with two researchers at the moment, Professor Bethany Johnson, research faculty associate in the Department of Communication at UNC Charlotte's Women and Girls Research Institute, and Dr. Margaret Quinlan, associate professor of communication and a core faculty member in the health psychology PhD program. You were talking about your own experience and some tests that you were going through, and you were embarking on a research project, and you just happened to be in New York, and you got a voicemail.
I got a voicemail.
And the voicemail did not help the process.
The voicemail was to report whether or not the last 6 weeks of treatment were a complete waste of time and money. I didn't know when I was going to get the call because they don't tell you, problem number one. I got the call at 7:38, so I was getting ready to get to the archives with Maggie that morning, and the voicemail said, you know, I hate leaving these voicemails on a patient's voicemail. I wish I wasn't telling you this. It looks like none of the embryos are going to make it through. We won't have anything to freeze. Basically, it's sort of, you know, I'm really sorry I had to tell you this. Give me a call back as soon as you can. Well, the problem was the office wasn't going to be open for another hour and a half, and this person didn't know that I couldn't call them back. So I had all of these questions. I had basically just been told this whole experience was an abject failure. I had no one to ask about it and no way to contact them. So I finally get in touch with them hours later, and all I wanted to do, I remember Maggie being so surprised. She said, what do you want to do? Do you need to take the day? Do we need to go home? And I was like, no, I need to get in the archive. I need to get my mind off of this. I can't do anything about it. 24 hours later, I found out through another phone call, which I didn't know when I was getting it, that miraculously two embryos sort of got it together, was the word on the voicemail, and were then frozen, and that maybe I would get pregnant with those later. And, you know, in the embryologist's defense, they don't have any training on how to leave these voicemails, and they didn't know the schedule. And this is a person who's responsible for taking these embryos, watching them so carefully. They're doing incredibly hard work. And this was someone just, you know, just trying to get me this news. But at the end of the first voicemail, it ended with, okay, have a good day. You know, and that's your sort of normal end to a voicemail. And I said to Maggie, how is this working like this? Am I the only one that this is happening to? What do we do?
Well, I think you had been to so many facilities and the same pattern kept happening. And you know, as somebody who does not have an infertility diagnosis, I see myself as an infertility ally. And so I said, you know, what can we do together? How can we make this process better? What do people need to know? And so that by the time we got home from that trip, we already had the questions that we wanted to ask women all written up, ready to send out, you know, for IRB approval.
And this falls right into this project. This is the genesis of the project.
Yeah.
And you just said, am I the only one that this is happening to? And what are you discovering? Was she the only one that this is happening?
No, she's not the only one. We have this manuscript under review about communication with nurses, and women talk about how you know, so much of it does happen outside of the fertility clinic, and being able to communicate with their nurses, and a lot of the miscommunication happens over technology, either the phone or email, or you know, some sort of communication breakdown, and so we kept seeing over and over again that, you know, that these patterns were existing, and that just small tweaks in how information was transmitted would have made a big improvement. And the women don't necessarily want the doctors and the nurses to do more work. It's just small little tweaks could improve the process for both the patient and the provider.
For a long time, we've heard that some doctors, and our doctors are never really taught about bedside manner, and that's why some of them choose not to be clinicians. They go to work and they do research because they don't like being around the patient. Is this more, is the bottom line here that this is more than bedside manner, or is it simpler than bedside? Is it just a choice of words and a choice of how you deliver the message?
I think it's both and. So one thing we heard over and over from participants is, I really would have liked the doctor to say my name when I'm in the room. Huh. So that is a free improvement. That costs you nothing to say the person's name. Alternatively, something that's more difficult is infertility treatment is very time sensitive. If you're getting an IVF treatment, for example, you might have to take a particular shot between a two-hour window. If there's any miscommunication about that, everything is lost if you don't get it done in that 2 hours. So how do you get in touch with someone immediately when you have a practice where they do have a lot of patients, they have a lot of people on these cycles, they're not doing a poor job, but what if you can't get a hold of anyone? So that's a harder question to answer and a bigger issue.
So what you're trying to do two things. You're trying to solve a problem here, but you're also trying to assess, as I understand it, how the patient perceives the interaction they're having with the medical community. And it may not be that the medical community is doing anything particularly wrong here. It's just that their perception is I'm not being treated the way I thought I would be treated and how I'd like to be treated in all of this. This does not sound unlike what Apple or any other big company that really needs to have a good customer experience would go through to find out what can we do to make this better.
Well, the one thing that we realized throughout the process is that the women are very aware that they're in an infertility industrial complex, and so they're paying a lot of money for hopefully having good care. And what we found is that the women in our study were often highly educated, upper middle class in heterosexual relationships, and they were at times putting up with bad care because the end goal of having a baby was so important to them. And, you know, what we hope this research does is to help people reflect on their own agency and what they need, that often women are seen as in throughout the history of medicine as being weak, as being sick, as that being their natural state. And women are taught to be passive. And so we want to help them understand disenfranchising messages and different ways that they can advocate for themselves, you know, throughout the process.
I'm not sure where you are in the process of this research, but when it's done, what will you do with it?
Well, like we said earlier, we've spoken at conferences. Being on Charlotte Talks was a big deal to us because there may be women and men listening right now that aren't sure if they're infertile, don't know where to go. And, you know, the opportunity to say to them, you're in a good city, look up Resolve, look up the resources, you know, just type into Google, infertility practices, Charlotte, and you will have plenty of material. There are very caring doctors, nurses, activists, community members here. You aren't alone in the process, and there are many things, you know, that you can do to help. And as Maggie was saying, we have heard a lot from our participants. I didn't want to upset the doctor. I didn't want to be perceived as too emotionally needy. I didn't want to do this XYZ. Well, if that's how people feel, and that's very common, they may not be saying to their doctors, I was hoping we could talk about this. I don't understand this. I have a question about this. Then the doctor doesn't know, and the doctor can't speak to what they don't know. So much of what we are trying to do through our publishing, through our community outreach, through connecting people is to be a bridge between doctors and patients and their concerns.
Because this is an emotional experience from the get-go.
Absolutely.
And it is a roller coaster. And it's also incredibly expensive and requires a great deal of the couple. Mm-hmm. Their involvement is the whole shooting match, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you're putting this on top of life that has to be lived whether they go through these treatments or not. And so it becomes even more emotional if you're not getting the kind of feedback that you'd like to get. We're going to be joined now by, by Dr. Lauren Johnson, a fertility specialist at Reproductive Endocrinology Associates of Charlotte, who has written peer-reviewed papers focusing on fertility preservation. She joins us by phone. Doctor, thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I want to go back to something we talked about at the very beginning of the program, and that was the fact that this is a disease. And that really surprised me. I had never heard that before. Why is infertility considered a disease?
Well, that's a great question. It is something that people don't really have any control over. So just like diabetes or high blood pressure, this isn't something that, for most people, they can treat on their own. It really is a medical condition. And I think if we gauge it in the context of this is a medical condition, this is a disease that there is treatment available for, then it takes some of those preconceived notions that people have about what helps people get pregnant kind of off the table. Yeah. I think it makes it more likely that people will seek out medical attention for this condition. Hmm.
CNN reports 1 in 8 couples seek fertility treatment each year. That sounds like an awfully high number. But among women, the number is 11.9% a year. Is that a high number when it comes to people being affected by a medical problem, no matter what it is?
I think that it certainly means that it's a very common condition, and I think that that's also a misconception. I think that people don't really see infertility, and so a lot of people don't realize how prevalent it is. I remember when I first got into this field and started saying to people, yes, this is what I do for a living, so many people would say to me, oh, we needed fertility treatment. We went through this. I have a friend who did this. It's not something necessarily that people talk about that much, but when you bring it up, there's a lot of people who've needed a little bit of help get pregnant, and I do think that it's an important thing for people to talk about, and I think it will continue to be something where more and more people are going to need treatment moving forward.
Why?
Well, one of the things that we know is that women are waiting longer to have babies. So if you look at, 30, 40 years ago, the age at first pregnancy in the United States was about 21. And in 2014, that was 26. You're seeing more and more women who are delaying families for work or career or for other things. And as people pursue other things in life, there will be issues that come up where we're just bumping up against a natural barrier for fertility. So I do think that it will be something that more and more people will need treatment for in the future.
Dr. Quinlan.
One thing that as we are increasing the conversation about the medicalization of infertility, the one thing I always like to talk with students about is the unintended consequences of that. That some people think, oh, you have an infertility diagnosis. That means you can just go and get IVF and it's fixed and it's taken care of. There's a cure for it. But what we've learned throughout our research is that there isn't a cure for all forms of infertility. And so just to be aware that messages that you send to friends and family, that with the assumption that there is a cure for everything is not fair.
And even the work Dr. Johnson does, you're sort of circumventing what doesn't work to hopefully get a pregnancy anyway, but you don't necessarily get rid of the idea of it being a disease. And I think Dr. Johnson mentioned earlier as well, there are all these ideas about what you can do to overcome infertility, and we don't actually have data collected showing that going on a cruise actually decreases infertility, or having some wine actually fixes problems with fibroid tumors in your uterus or endometrial tissue or any of those things. But very well-meaning people who want to support people with infertility in their life will say, maybe you should just relax, but if we're thinking about this, as Dr. Johnson said, in terms of a disease or something that is inside your body, not inside your habits on the weekend,
That comment, maybe you should just relax, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you're all the experts here, might stem from the fact that so often people who are having trouble conceiving will go through all the hoops that we're talking about here through the infertility treatments and struggle with that for months, maybe even years, and finally they are successful, finally. And then 9 months later, they have another child with no effort whatsoever. So it was almost like relieving the anxiety of not being able to have that first child allowed them to, quote-unquote, relax into that. But you're saying that is not what's going on here.
No, and I think so I'll give you another instance where that happens a lot. People will say, you should just adopt. I know everyone seems to know someone who adopted and then 20 minutes later got pregnant. So the first problem with that is, why would you bring a child into your home to hope that you would have another child? Right. Very unfair to the first child, right? But secondly, the research about that, the highest percentage I've ever seen was 5%. So 5% of people adopting because they couldn't have a child are likely. That means 95% of the time, it's unlikely that you will get pregnant.
What are the most common, Dr. Johnson, what are the most common causes of infertility?
Well, I would say that one of the most common conditions I treat is an ovulation disorder. So about 25% of couples, it'll be an issue of an egg just not being released on a regular basis. I mentioned already that age can be a factor here, and that's also another common cause is as women age, their egg number goes down, and so low egg number can be an issue as well. Just as low egg number can cause trouble, a low sperm count can also cause trouble. And I think people don't realize that in about 40% of couples, there is some contribution for a low sperm count. In addition, some women will have fallopian tubes that don't work so that the egg and sperm can't get to each other. And that can happen when women go ahead and tie their tubes and then decide later they want to have children. Or sometimes people will have other surgeries that cause scar tissue, and that can cause the fallopian tubes to be blocked. It sounds like you guys have discussed already uterine fibroids, which are benign growths on the uterus that can alter the architecture of the uterus, and that can cause trouble getting pregnant. There are conditions such as something called endometriosis that can also cause issues. And then in about 20% of cases, we actually never find a cause. So it's something called unexplained infertility. I tell my patients that it's an incredibly frustrating diagnosis because they go through all of this testing, and then we say, well, I can't tell you exactly what the cause is. There is treatment, but sometimes it can be difficult to say, there's no reason why this is happening.
How many treatment options are available to you, given all the various conditions that may lead to the problem in the first place? How many treatment options are there? What are the most successful treatment options in your opinion? And how expensive are they? And does insurance pay for any of it?
So, in terms of options, the most common thing that we try is medication to stimulate the ovaries. People have often heard of a medication called Clomid, and are medications that essentially will get the ovaries to release one or more eggs, and that is very common. Surgery is a very common treatment, and then sometimes when we're using medications to stimulate the ovaries, we pair that with something called an intrauterine insemination, which is where sperm is actually placed inside the uterus. And if you look at that group of treatments, that's going to be probably 85 to 90% of people who go through fertility treatment. And those options, whereas they're not cheap, are not as expensive as some of the other things that are out there. When you talk about sort of what's the most expensive, what's the most successful, we're really looking at what's called in vitro fertilization or IVF. Essentially a process where the ovaries are stimulated with medication, eggs are removed from the body, placed with a partner sperm in the lab, and then embryos are grown and put back in the woman's uterus.
And let me stop you there because we have to take a break. We'll come right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Brookdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew. Details at thecorkscrew.com. Candidates.com. All three GOP candidates gather in California for a statewide convention. Prospects for frontrunner Donald Trump as the nomination race heads into the final stretch, the ongoing divide within the party, and what it means for the general election. That's the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your shot. You can get to us via email at WFAE.org. CharlotteTalks@WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
I'm WFAE General Manager Joe O'Connor. Thanks to all of our members, donors, and sponsors whose support enabled our amazing news team to win not just one, but two regional Edward R. Murrow Awards, including the award for outstanding breaking news coverage and, for the second year in a row, the award for overall excellence. You can hear our award-winning stories and so much more on our website, WFAE.org. Again, thanks from all of us here at WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about infertility today with Dr. Lauren Johnson, a fertility specialist with Reproductive Endocrinology Associates of Charlotte, also two researchers with us who are looking into how women and medical professionals and men, couples and medical professionals, can better communicate with each other so that their expectations can be made can be met in a very difficult time, particularly for the couple. We're talking to Professor Bethany Johnson about that and Dr. Margaret Quinlan. Dina on Twitter says, thank you for this conversation. I'm a new patient and just experienced an insensitive doctor. So, Dr. Johnson, do you get patients who have come to you because they've been to another doctor that they just couldn't talk to, couldn't communicate with? What seems to be the problem? Because doctors surely know that this is a very tough, sensitive, emotional subject.
Yeah. It certainly is an incredibly emotional time. And, you know, in those situations where, you know, someone goes to a provider and the communication isn't happening, you know, I don't know that that's always that there's a fault on one side or the other. It's kind of almost like a relationship in that different things are going to work for different people. And, you know, the style that one particular provider has may not be something that matches up with an individual couple's need. And so, you know, I think part of this is just finding someone that that you feel comfortable with, you feel like you communicate well with. But it doesn't always mean that there's an issue. It just, you know, just like in life, when with any kind of conversation, sometimes different styles just don't work for individual couples. But I definitely have heard patients say that, and it can be an incredibly frustrating thing.
I'm so glad Dr. Johnson said that. We've put that in the conclusion of a lot of our research. I had a situation. I've had incredible doctors that I've worked with who were just clear communicators, answered my question, talked to me like I was a thinking person. And I've had a doctor ask me a question and roll their eyes while I was speaking, and that doctor did not remain my doctor. So I was able to use my agency as a patient and say, this is not a good communicative fit. I need to go to another doctor. But maybe not everyone knows that they can do that.
I've forgotten how many patients you've already talked to. That's hundreds of hours of interviews. I know that. In those interviews where you've talked to these people, have you been able to determine whether poor communication on the part of the doctor has impacted the outcome in any way?
That's an interesting question. We had one individual who emailed us a follow-up, you know, to say that she believed that she became pregnant as a result of having better communication with her practitioners and
a really great nurse.
Yeah. And so you know, I don't think we understand the role of stress on the body and how that can impact an experience. So
but I think what's important here is that whether or not it actually impacts it, what we're finding is the patient perceives that it has an impact, and that's something very important for doctors, nurses, and other practitioners to know, whether or not it actually impacts versus the perception that there is an impact. Yeah. And that, you know, I know that doctors like Dr. Johnson are really cognizant of the way their patients think about the process coming into the room, and if the patient believes good communication is going to make the difference, it sort of doesn't matter whether or not it does. It matters in that moment.
And if somebody feels that they can ask the doctor a question, that they're negotiating that power dynamic, that the patients go in knowing that the doctor does have a lot of power in that relationship. And so, you know, different ways to help with those balance, you know, balancing that power.
So the two of you have interviewed 25 people or so, women, with infertility diagnoses across the country about media representation of fertility myths, metaphors that women use to discuss their fertility process, doctor-patient communication difficulties, the role of technology in nurse-patient communication. Let's start with the media. What myths is the media perpetrating or perpetuating and presenting?
Well, you heard Dr. Johnson say that about 85% of the time there is a combination of surgery, ovulatory drugs, and something like IUI or intrauterine insemination. But the only thing anyone knows about is IVF. Right? And that's because that's what's usually in the movies. And IUI has about, and Dr. Johnson can correct me on this if I'm wrong, about a 20% success rate, which makes you equal to someone who does not have infertility. You have a 20% chance commonly of getting pregnant on a month-to-month basis. But if you watch the backup plan with Jennifer Lopez, you would never know because she gets pregnant on, you know, the first go and gets pregnant with twins, and it's so inconvenient, you know, and then she's pregnant again before the end of the movie. So, you know, it's just pregnancy on top of pregnancy on top of pregnancy. And if you see these kind of films, you might assume it's going to be very easy, it's going to work the first time, or you're just going to head straight to IVF because that seems to be the only thing that works in the movies.
And women of color are also shown as being more fertile.
Yeah.
And that's a myth that we know, that African-American women are equally as unfertile as Caucasian women, and maybe even more, have more infertility issues, and there's more taboo and more stigma against talking about fertility issues in different communities. So when we see these images on TV, it perpetuates these myths. And even the language that the doctors will use on some of the television shows that we looked at, or movies that we looked at, talking about a woman having a hostile uterus, that is not a useful diagnosis that in, you know, in 2016, but we still see these myths over and over again.
So lesson one, don't pay attention to the movies.
Yeah.
Don't pay attention to Dr. Marcus Welby. Why is it important that we understand the metaphors that women use when they're discussing this? And what kinds of metaphors are we talking about?
We didn't initially look for metaphors. We just kept finding them over and over in our transcripts, so we decided to look more closely at them.
Give me an example of a metaphor.
Secret Service, we heard a lot. We heard cattle call, factory, belt, things like that. And what that was important to us because it gave us a window into when patients had a bad experience with their practitioner, what it felt like for them. They would always use these metaphors that had to do with factories, industry, or they would say, you know, I had to use Secret Service to get to my doctor. You know, sort of like the doctor was the president. It was very hard to get to the doctor to actually ask a question. And that really, those metaphors were powerful because they gave us an idea when it's not working well, what it feels like for the patient. That's valuable information for practitioners too.
Right. Feeling like cattle going through the process. There are ways that practitioners and patients can talk about the process so they don't feel like cattle going through the process.
Have you been talking to Dr. Johnson about these findings?
We have communicated with interested doctors. We've been able to share some of our work. Dr. Johnson can probably talk more about this, but I know at REACH they're working on some technology, some phone application maybe even, that will make it easier for patients to get in touch with their practitioners, particularly for younger millennial patients, texting and live chat and things like that.
If it's not on the phone, it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
That's right. So have you heard these metaphors being used in your clinic, in your clinical experience, doctor, or is this something that women talk about outside of the office?
Well, I think it's both. The metaphor of a factory or sort of a cattle call, you know, that's definitely something that I've heard patients refer to, especially at some of the larger fertility centers around the country. And that, you know, in my mind, that's so sad because, you know, as a practitioner, you never want your patient to feel that way. And I think it's great that we have people who are doing research in this area, because the first step is really to know kind of what is the experience like for the patient. And as a provider, sometimes it can be tough to know what your patient's going through. How does the lab work, and how does the appointment schedule go, and the process and experience of being a patient. And so it's great to know what these experiences are for patients so that we can try to make the process better for them.
Are there things going on in treatment or research or things that are coming up on the horizon right now that really excite you?
Well, I would say that probably the most exciting thing in fertility treatment right now is actually a process called vitrification. So it's a term and a technology that essentially refers to a fast freeze of either an egg or an embryo. And, you know, it doesn't sound very exciting when you just say it that way, but when I think about the implications, it's been really dramatic. So that process where you can really fast freeze things, essentially it prevents ice crystals from forming and it sort of protects the egg or the embryo from damage. And what that means is that we can take people through an IVF cycle and really increase the safety and also the efficacy of their treatment. At this point, the chance of success from a frozen transfer sometimes can be better than a fresh transfer for people who go through IVF, and that's a dramatic change. And then the other thing that does is really allow us to have people freeze their eggs. People have been freezing eggs since the 80s, but it hasn't been really successful until probably the last 5 to 10 years. Really, that trend has been from this vitrification procedure. And so now if you have a woman who, let's say, has a cancer diagnosis and needs to go through treatment before she's finished her family, she can freeze eggs for the future. Or if you have a woman who, let's say, just hasn't met the right person and they know that they're getting a little bit older and they want to have a child in the future, they can freeze their eggs and improve the likelihood that they can have that child in the future.
You're also, I'm told, intrigued by the possibility that ovaries can produce new eggs, because at the moment the theory is that you're born with all the eggs that you will ever produce and right. You just release them over time. When you're done, you're done. That's not necessarily true, though, you're finding.
Well, for right now, we think that that's the case, but there is some research that's ongoing that's looking to see, is there any way to push the ovary to make additional eggs? Now, I will say that this is something that's very, very early stage research, and definitely is far from a clinical application at this point, but I think that research is super intriguing because, you know, if we could really push the ovary to make more eggs, that would totally revolutionize fertility treatment. So I'm really interested to see how that research pans out over the next 5 to 10 years. So it's one of those stay tuned moments. It's not something we can do yet. But, you know, fertility treatment and research has come such a long way so quickly. And, you know, it would be amazing if we could see something like that come along in the future.
And recently there was a uterine transplant. It was not successful, but it was the first ever. And usually the first ever of anything is not successful. But does that hold any legitimate promise for the future?
It absolutely does, and it's interesting because the uterine transplant that was done that you're hearing about was the one that was done in the United States, and that was not successful. But there have actually been several that were done in Sweden not that long ago, and there have been 5 children that have been born after uterine transplant in Sweden. And so, you know, this is really something that you know has been successful, and that's part of that, you know, just example of fertility treatment and reproductive medicine and really pushing the boundaries and challenging what we thought was possible. And I think that's amazing.
I ran across a new term in preparing for this conversation today, and that is the two words, fertility privilege. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
That is connected to the idea that if you can easily conceive and or carry a child to term, there are just things about life that doesn't occur to you, may be painful to your friends with infertility. And because a lot of people don't share with their whole community because of the taboo around it, you may not know that people around you are going through infertility treatment. And so if we have people, if you know someone that's infertile, there are a number of really helpful things that you can do and sort of step outside of that privilege a little bit. And I would say the first thing is don't give infertile people advice.
Of any kind?
I would say the best advice you could give them is if they like to work out, you could advise them about a fun new workout they could do, and maybe you could do together with them on the weekend. I think there are so many pressures for people going through infertility. The best kind of support is people that are just willing to listen or to continue to live life with you.
So what should you say if you are a fertile person and you have children? And you know somebody who's been trying to have children or doesn't have children. Maybe you don't know that they've been trying. What do you say?
Well, I've learned some of this from making mistakes, right? But I think what I've learned is just asking your friend struggling with infertility what you can do to support them. Mm-hmm. Going to appointments. I took Bethany to an appointment, you know, one time when she needed someone to drive her home. You know, saying you support them, that you care about them, that you're interested in it. I think also we have Mother's Day coming up and Father's Day coming up, and those are particularly painful days for individuals struggling with infertility. So, you know, remembering them and thinking about other ways of mothering that are, you know, potentially at this point seen as untraditional, but, you know, that we need to, as a culture, change the conversation and broaden who's considered a mother and what that means for
people.
One
of the most beautiful gifts I got was a Mother's Day a number of years ago. I got a card from a friend who it arrived right around Mother's Day, and it said, I just want to celebrate all the ways that you create, all the things that you gave birth to academically this year, all the ways that you mother people in your lives. And it was so lovely to be thought of on that day.
We only have 45 seconds left here, but Dr. Johnson, I'm curious. This is not just a women's problem. It's a man's problem, too. What are treatment options for men? Are there any number of options for men, or is it simply trying to maximize what they have so that they can inseminate their wife?
Well, there are some options for men. Quickly, you know, there's medication sometimes that can increase sperm count, and inseminations can also be paired with that. But in general, you know, same things apply for men and women. Healthy lifestyle, exercise, those sorts of things, decreasing, things like smoking and environmental factors can be hugely helpful when you talk about sperm counts.
Dr. Lauren Johnson is a fertility specialist with Reproductive Endocrinology Associates of Charlotte Reach, as we heard a moment ago. Dr. Margaret Quinlan, Associate Professor of Communication, Core Faculty Member of the Health Psychology PhD program at UNC Charlotte, who is working on a research project with Professor Bethany Johnson, a research faculty associate in the Department of Communication, research affiliate as well at UNC Charlotte's Women and Girls Research Institute. Thank you all for the hour.